This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, wages and masks and earmarks, oh my. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, 13 May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Let me just get this out of the way up front. The biggest economic story of the day, hands down and going away. The CDC saying this afternoon that in almost every situation, if you are fully vaxxed, whether you're inside or out, masks are no longer necessary. Yes, you got to follow state and local guidance. Businesses do get to decide what their rules are. Don't be a jerk. But soon-ish, the virus might not be in charge of this economy anymore. Another indicator along those lines, this being Thursday, the weekly report on first-time claims for unemployment benefits came out this morning. 473,000 people applied last week, continuing the downward trend, which is good, but not good enough.
It shows that the economy is getting back to a better track, but we're not out of the woods yet.
Adriana Kugler is a professor of economics and public policy at Georgetown.
You still have many people who are even out of the labor force.
Women especially, we saw that in the unemployment report last Friday, right?
People have increased risks of getting back into their jobs. They have to take care of their children who are not fully in person in many school systems.
Bottom line, though,
I suspect they're going to continue to keep falling.
People are getting vaccinated, getting more comfortable going to work. Also, by the by, politics.
Six states have already cut off people of benefits ahead of the September 6th expiration date of the rescue plan.
Adriana Kugler there at Georgetown helping us out. Okay, related to unemployment, jobs, and people getting back, wages. We mentioned Chipotle the other day. Average hourly wage there is going up to $15 an hour. And now some McDonald's workers are going to be getting a raise, too. The burger chain is increasing hourly wages at the restaurant it owns, as opposed to franchisees, by about 10%. McDonald's says its average hourly wage is going to be $15 an hour by 2024. And yes, average is doing a lot of work at both of those companies, but still a positive trend, right? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports that yes, it is. Raises are in store for some Americans, but don't get your hopes up.
Most CEOs do not wake up in the morning and think, gee, how can I spend more on labor today? And yet, they've been raising pay.
They are desperate.
Gad Levinon heads the Conference Board's Labor Market Institute.
We just have a major labor shortage right now.
Might seem curious to have a labor shortage when there are 10 million unemployed people in the U.S., but that's the pandemic. On the one hand, things are opening up and everyone's hiring all at the same time. And on the other hand,
many people who are kind of listed as unemployed, but are actually not seriously trying to find a job for various reasons.
Some people have kids or parents at home they have to take care of. Some people are still worried about getting sick. And for some of the lowest income workers, Levinon says,
the high unemployment benefit in some cases pay more than one would get by working.
So what do? You raise wages. Alan Detmeister is an economist with UBS.
Wage growth in the leisure and hospitality group, which is the lowest wage group, that's been roughly 16% at an annual rate over the last 3 months.
But here's the thing about raising wages. It is difficult to unraise them. So they're kind of permanent. Daniel Zhao is a senior economist with Glassdoor.
Permanent wage increases are interesting because they're a signal that businesses perceive a long-term challenge in attracting workers at current wages.
Some companies are offering signing bonuses instead of raising pay. Still, this wage spiking situation may not last that long. Justin Widener is a U.S. economist with Deutsche Bank. He says sooner or later, workers will come flooding back.
For example, if school is able to go back fully in the fall, that would free up a large chunk of potential labor force to come back online.
Before the pandemic, the balance of power between workers and employers had been drifting to the side of employers. Right now, it's swinging back to workers. The question is, how long will it stay there? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Two observations about Wall Street today. Number one, inflation. What inflation? Also, all y'all make up your minds, will ya? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is just a lot of money flowing out of Washington right now. All the various virus relief programs, and to the tune of $800 billion to $2 trillion, depending on how the politics play out, President Biden's infrastructure plans. I mention all the money because as Congress works on some of its more ho-hum spending bills, an old Washington standby is making a comeback. Earmarks, money that lawmakers ask for projects back home. As Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports, they do have the pros and their cons.
On the pro side, earmarks can get lawmakers to work together because both Republicans and Democrats have skin in the game, say money in a bill for new roads in their districts. Henrietta Trays is with Veda Partners, which provides political analysis for investors.
It is infinitely more difficult to vote against or obstruct a bill that provides direct aid that you personally have requested for your constituents.
But on the con side, in the past, earmarks sometimes led to corruption. Kevin Kosar, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, says some lawmakers fell into what he calls sleazy relationships with lobbyists for big corporations who wanted earmark money.
Lobbyists would approach them for earmarks, and legislatures would give the earmarks, and then meanwhile, this would result in campaign donations going to the legislator. Or perks like trip to go play golf in Scotland.
This is why earmarks were basically banned about a decade ago. They're being revived with safeguards. For-profit corporations are no longer eligible for earmarks. Ed Mills is Washington policy analyst for Raymond James, a current Marketplace underwriter. He says the safeguards took a little of the tarnish off of earmarks for lawmakers.
The ability to say, yes, we are doing it, but there are restrictions in place.
Also, earmark requests have to be public. They'll be audited, and lawmakers have to prove people back home really want them. Mills says right now the safeguards are strong enough to keep the cons of earmarking from outweighing the pros. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Tomorrow morning, on the early side, might I recommend for your listening pleasure, David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report. Everything you need to know to start your business day. If there is one question that unites would-be home buyers in this economy, it's this. What's it gonna take? What is it going to take? Because calling this a seller's market doesn't really do it. Redfin, for instance, says nearly two-thirds of the offers its agents made in March wound up in a bidding war. And with so many buyers making bids way over asking and waiving contingencies or coming in with all cash offers, there's not a whole lot left to toss into the deal to sweeten the pot. So hopeful buyers are trying a different approach that has nothing to do with money. For the latest installment of our series, Adventures in Housing Marketplaces, Amy Scott reports on the rise of the emotional appeal.
Let's set the scene. An older couple is selling the home they've owned for 45 years in Fairless Hills, Pennsylvania. They sift through 22 competing offers, comparing prices and contingencies. One of them includes this.
Dear Mr. and Mrs. Miller, thank you for providing us with the opportunity to view your beautiful home and for considering our offer.
By the time Brittany Hetherington and her fiancé Matt Thornton wrote this letter, they'd already lost out on 6 houses. They started with flattery.
Finding the right words to describe our feelings as we toured the property has been tough, but to put it simply, we loved it.
Then played up Brittany's local connections.
Brittany is a Fairless Hills native and excited to put down roots near her childhood home.
To sweeten the deal, they offered to rent the house back to the Millers at a discount if their new house wasn't ready in time for closing.
And then we also included a couple of pictures from our engagement shoot as well. So we were like, look how cute we are.
It seemed to work. Matt says the Millers accepted their offer for the 5-bedroom colonial, even though it wasn't the highest.
Their realtor indicated as much. I mean, it was, she said specifically, they loved the fact that we were locals and that we knew the area and had a connection, naming the families on the street that she went to school with.
There's a term for love letters like these in the real estate business. Yep, love letters. Amanda Pullman has seen a lot of them as a broker with Keller Williams in suburban Cleveland, especially lately.
And it's more prevalent than ever now because there's so little inventory and every buyer wants every house.
Pullman actually advises against the practice. Just listen to this example and see if you can spot the problem.
Oh, we love your house so much and we can just imagine our kids running down the staircase at Christmas.
The hypothetical writer of that letter revealed 2 details.
Religion and familial status.
That are protected classes under the Fair Housing Act. The others are race, color, sex, national origin, and disability. It's illegal for sellers or their agents to discriminate against buyers based on any of those factors.
If those factors are revealed in a letter and a seller relies on that information, there could be a fair housing problem.
Brian Green is VP for Policy Advocacy at the National Association of Realtors. Last year, the group warned its members to steer clear of love letters and educate their clients about the risks.
Now, I think it's very important to point out that I'm not aware of any federal lawsuit filed anywhere in America alleging discrimination on the basis of one of these letters.
It's also not clear how effective these letters are. Margie Gillespie is a realtor with Remax Components in the Baltimore area. She says the seller could be an investor.
They don't have any emotional tie whatsoever to the house.
And even when sellers are emotionally attached?
At the end of the day, numbers talk. Sellers will take the highest bid in most cases.
Try telling that to a would-be homebuyer after their 6th rejection. Broker Amanda Pullman tells clients if they're determined to send a letter,
don't make it anything about the people. No photos, no descriptions. Just make it about the property.
Or, as with one house she recently sold, about the dog.
It was like the dog wrote the letter, the dog had his picture, the dog said he liked the yard.
No fair housing issues, and the seller just happened to be a dog lover. Also, it was the best offer. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Do us a favor, would you? Tell us about your adventures in housing. You can do that, and you can check out the rest of our series at marketplace.org. Coming up.
All 400 of my classmates, you know, won the lottery that day.
Right place, meet right time. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 433 points today, 1.2%, 34,021. The NASDAQ up 93 points, 0.7%, ended at 13,124. The S&P 500 grew 49 points, about 1.2%. Finish it at 41-12. Boeing up 0.8% today. The plane maker said it has the green light from the FAA to make some fixes to a problem with its electrical system that has grounded more than 100 of its 737 MAX jets. The 3 American airlines that operated the 737 MAX also moved higher today. American improved 2.1%. United picked up 2.7%. Southwest rallied 2.9%. Lowe's hammered up 2.6% after an upgrade from Oppenheimer. Rival Home Depot also gained 2.6%. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.65%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey there, and thank you for being a dedicated listener. Now I'm hoping I can count on you as a supporter. Donations from people like you keep Marketplace going. And when you donate today, you can get our limited edition Marketplace Summer Tote Bag as a thank you gift. Honestly, it's a summer tote bag. It's sturdy. It's got a cool design from an artist who is a fan of the show. Don't miss out. Step up and give today at marketplace.org/donate.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is credit card news afoot. It's from the Wall Street Journal this morning. Some of the biggest banks in this economy, JP Morgan and Wells Fargo among them, are going to start issuing credit cards to people without credit scores. That is unusual. And the paper reports the banks are going to look instead at savings and checking account history. Obviously, it's just a pilot program, but if it works, it'd be quite the change in how banks do business, since so much of our financial infrastructure, think access to housing, the ability to get a car loan, even jobs, can all ride on those credit scores. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab called up some experts. Here you go.
If you're a longtime credit card user, it can be hard to even imagine how you got your first one. Maybe a parent co-signed, or you opened a joint account, or you made a couple $100 security deposit to get a low limit line. A lot of people don't have access to any of that.
Immigrants, formerly incarcerated people, people who perhaps were in a relationship where the credit score is more reflective of the other partner.
Lisa Servon researches economic insecurity at the University of Pennsylvania. 26 million Americans are credit invisible, according to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and many of them are Black or Latinx. Servon says credit accessibility favors generational wealth, even though studies show income isn't the best indicator of financial responsibility.
Traditional credit scores don't take into account a lot of the things that would show that someone is capable of paying back their debt.
Many experts say measuring cash flow in checking and savings accounts paints a more accurate picture. And that's what this pilot program will do. Look at average balances over time and overdraft fees. But people who rely on debit cards are more likely to be hurt by those. Rebecca Bornay at the Center for Responsible Lending calls banks' use of them predatory.
The fees that they charge for overdrafts are so high that it makes it difficult for people to recover when they get hit with, you know, three or four overdraft fees in a single day.
It's why Chi-Chi Wu at the National Consumer Law Center would like to see a combination of data points that determine credit card eligibility. Rent, utilities,
telecom payments, cable, internet, some other types of recurring payments like Netflix can be useful.
She says there's no one perfect formula. For instance, looking at rent during the pandemic isn't ideal. But a combination of these things would create an opt-in system that redefines what financial responsibility means. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Tax accountants kind of had to adapt on the fly this year when the IRS announced tax day was going to be the 17th of May instead of April the 15th, the second year in a row it's been slid, as you know. Michael Durant, one of the 10 people we've been following in our series, The United States of Work, is one of those tax accountants, and he sent this advice for those of you out there who still have not filed.
Call your accountant. Call your accountant right now. And apologize and get your stuff in, and so that we can all go on and have a great Memorial weekend. I am so ready. I am so ready. It's been a good staggered pace. I think this was the right choice. Last year we did July 15th. It was way too long. Clients took to July 15th. This year I think a lot of them said 30 days is not much of a difference. We'll send it in, and I will be emailing my legislator to see if he will make that a permanent choice there. The May 15th, I think it was a good pace, and I think most of us would agree. as a tax accountant, I find it hard to let someone else do my taxes. I have not filed my taxes yet. They are 99% there. I just want to give it that final review. As some of your viewers might remember, I'm in law school, so I just finished finals yesterday. So now I'm going to do my tax return and get it done before May 17th.
Michael Durand from our series, The United States of Work, Monday, people, Monday. This is commencement weekend at a lot of colleges and universities, including at historically black Morehouse College in Atlanta. 2 years ago, a guy by the name of Robert F. Smith delivered the commencement address at Morehouse, not in and of itself newsworthy, except that this Robert F. Smith is a billionaire investor and philanthropist. And in the course of his speech, Mr. Smith offered up a $34 million surprise. Marketplace's Samantha Fields checked in with the Morehouse class of 2019.
Robert F. Smith had already been speaking for more than half an hour when he made the surprise announcement.
This is my class, 2019, and my family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans.
Frank Lawrence Jr. was in the audience, and he just remembers thinking,
is this really happening? It was extremely surreal.
Lawrence wasn't even supposed to be in the class of 2019.
I was originally in the class of 2018.
But his junior year, he ended up getting a D in a psychology class.
And because of that, I was held back a year.
At the time, he was pretty upset, but it turned out to be his lucky break, because if he'd passed that class and graduated when he was supposed to,
I would have had to pay back $65,000 in student loans.
Instead, every penny of those loans that Lawrence and his mom took out to pay for his Morehouse degree was paid off, and that has changed everything.
Over the last 2 years, it's been so significant because I have that space and freedom to take risks. I've made decisions that I wouldn't have thought I would ever make.
Like quitting a job that wasn't quite right and trying to start his own nonprofit. Not having to make student loan payments has also meant Lawrence has been able to save a good chunk of money and start investing.
It was something that I was always interested in, but I knew that I didn't have the capital or the time to invest in investing.
But now he does. He invests about $90 every 2 weeks in the stock market.
I'm able to start that now and then see where it puts me in a year to 5 years from now.
It is still too early to really know how much Robert F. Smith's gift will change things for the Morehouse class of 2019.
It was something that even to this day, I can't like completely process because it's something, you know, people say, I want to win the lottery. But in a way, like I all 400 of my classmates, you know, won the lottery that day.
Jarvis Mays was one of the co-valedictorians of the class. He says getting out of Morehouse debt-free has given him more peace of mind in medical school. He's currently in his second year at the University of Pennsylvania.
I knew that the path that I was on was going to accrue a lot of debt.
More than 40% of medical students start with undergraduate debt.
So to kind of focus on school and not necessarily look at a number and know that that's waiting for me to pay back, I think that was a huge relief that kind of made me go into medical school with a clearer head.
It's also been amazing, Mays says, to see what his friends and classmates who aren't still in school are doing.
A lot of my classmates I talk to now that are working are now in a position to buy homes or invest or even have the opportunity to start to kind of accumulate some sort of wealth.
Things many of them otherwise wouldn't have been in a position to do for years. Elijah Dormius feels so lucky to be part of that Morehouse class of 2019.
Oh, blessed. Blessed, luckily loved. I think it's loved. I think that's the best word.
Dormius and his mom, who raised 9 kids in a low-income housing complex in New York City, took out over $100,000 in loans to pay for Morehouse. Having all of that paid off lifted a huge burden, he says, for him, his mom, and his younger siblings.
Now my brothers can go to college, offer. They can get scholarships, offer. They can do anything they want.
And Dormius is determined to pay it forward and help other students from low-income backgrounds. That is something Robert F. Smith charged the class of 2019 with doing in his graduation speech that day.
And I want my class to look at these alumnus, these beautiful Morehouse brothers, and let's make sure every class has the same opportunity going forward.
2 years later, Smith now meets with his class once a month to talk about how to do that. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a very brief dip into cryptocurrencies. Brief because it's more likely than not that the price will have completely changed by the time you hear this. Bitcoin traded as low as $47,000 today. Not too long ago, you might remember it was at $64,000 plus. Maybe it was Elon Musk saying he wasn't going to let people pay for Teslas with crypto anymore. Concerned about the environmental impact, he said. Maybe that was it. Or maybe it's just crazy volatile and get used to it? All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. A last gasp at inflation until the next time it comes up, I guess. Remember all the wailing and gnashing of teeth yesterday at the Consumer Price Index? Well, the Producer Price Index came out this morning. Prices at the wholesale level up 6.2% in April from a year ago. That is, yes, a lot. But again, base effects, people. April a year ago was lousy. Month to month, though, the metric that Sabri pointed out for us in his story yesterday, a hefty 0.6% increase March to April this year. Inflation is going to be a story all summer long. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Cardine, the Parker, Beth Perlman, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.